case that the power at work in the heart of addiction is actually the very nature of sin in our world. I have come to believe that at the heart of every addiction and every sin is actually this hyper preoccupation with the self. In other words, we all have one. Consequently, I will also make the case today that healing for such a universal condition is not found merely in abstinence, or what we sometimes call sobriety. Sobriety as abstinence is no more a cure for addiction than a list of don'ts might constitute a thriving faith in Christ. So, okay, just jumping right into it, I have also come to believe that the well-meaning ways in which the church addresses addiction have been compromised by the values of this particular culture and has resulted in compounding challenges facing individuals who find themselves trapped in the particular addiction of substance abuse or other moralized vices. So today you may hear some other things that you want to apply, and I beg you to go there. Just whatever this context is, please go there in your own heart. First, I want to begin by reviewing the classic definition of addiction. Merriam-Webster defines it as a strong and harmful need to regularly have something, so like a drug, or do something, we might say gamble, and the antonym, of course, is sobriety. Okay, but I don't really fully buy into this definition, at least not functionally. I think the words all make sense in a certain grammatical order, but I want to dig into how we use this term. Not how we use it, I don't agree with that, or rather, who we get to assign it to, or who we choose not to assign this term to. So, but the question still remains, what is addiction? What is its cure? Maybe the more pressing question for those of us who love people who are in a certain situation of harm. To be honest, my time in urban ministry over the past 10 years has taught me to ask a bit of a different question. And that question was, why is addiction? If addiction is something like a strong and harmful need to regularly have something or do something, I have to say, I'm uncertain that description excludes me. And yet I've never been called an alcoholic in my life. You know, I could come up with a list of 10 things off the top of my head for which I have a strong and harmful need for, on a regular basis, too. Though these 10 things might more commonly be described as vices rather than addiction, but I hope that we see together that there's very little difference, really. I began asking myself, if the definition of addiction describes my own life, then what is it I'm trying to accomplish with other adults in urban ministry in the first place? Okay, so these were really hard questions to discover when I began to immerse myself in the life of gang members and drug dealers and substance abusers, all of whom became very close friends of mine. Why is addiction? In short, I can tell you I found an answer. As it is with any question worth asking, it could only really be found in a story. It could really only be lived as an experience. Okay, here we go. The following story is what led me to this particular presentation today. When I asked God, why is addiction, God? I was led to a confession. It was really simple. I am John Dunn. I am John Dunn. That was my confession. Let me explain more. I first uttered this phrase on bended knee in a closet. It wasn't the last time that I said it, and I have found the need to say it many times since then. I am John Joseph Dunn. The real John Dunn, who goes by that name in real life, is my brother. Or he often has called it a brother from another mother. John grew up in a poor historic African-American neighborhood in Abilene, Texas, called the Stevenson neighborhood. His father was absent a lot of his childhood. His mother worked long hours away from home, and she's an awesome mom. It's not something that she chose as a difficulty for their life. I wouldn't want you to hear that. the Stevenson neighborhood saw a rise in old-school gang activity in the 1980s, and by the 1990s, a significant portion of adult males have been put into prison under the U.S. War on Drugs, which some have come to call the mass incarceration movement. Mm-hmm. I don't want to overly politicize this. I just kind of want to give some context. With the depletion of male role models in this community, and in an attempt to find actual belonging, John was jumped into the Crips at the age of 14. By 19, John had been identified as a suspect, and in truth, he did it, on accounts of arson, one account of grand theft auto, illegal possession of firearms, and distribution of narcotics. But making matters only slightly worse, as I came to believe, he was addicted to the substance that he sold to other people. So, yeah, I know. Having said all that, it doesn't really look like we're anything alike, maybe, on the surface, but I promise I am John Dunn. One day I was visiting John at the county jail in Abilene, Texas, waiting for the latest charges to process at the courthouse, which takes a long time sometimes in a scandalously long fashion. He was crying. I was crying because he was crying. Our sobs were incoherent over the muffled, crappy telephones that you look at each other, you know, across the glass there. And I was wondering how I could keep doing this kind of ministry. He was wondering if he would ever outlive all of his sentencings, all of his convictions. But he said something. As John pleaded for me and my roommates to front the cash for his bail, he made a really interesting promise. He said, "Okay, this time I can do it. I promise. I can be like you guys. I'll do everything you tell me to do. I'll dress different. I'll stop cussing." I'd need to stop cussing if he thought that was the measure. "I won't do drugs anymore. I won't drink anymore. I'll go back to church. I'll go to college." Okay, I could go on and on. It was a really long confession. On and on and on he went, listing all the ways he could change and become a good person. In short, he promised to become a middle-class white male. In line with certain proper Bible Belt suburban church culture tendencies. Man, that part just, it got me really deep. Can I say that part again? When he promised to be a good person, he promised to be a middle class, white male, in line with particular southern Bible Belt church culture tendencies. Okay, at that moment I realized I probably hadn't been preaching the gospel of Christ because his gospel is for the poor. His gospel is for the oppressed, for the slave, and the sick. All the things that in a stereotypical way described my brother John. John, how he was, where he was, who he is. But as for myself, I think I confess that I was preaching the gospel of the rich white man. I thought salvation for people like John meant helping them look more like me. I realized in that moment that looking like me had a lot more to do with my privileged circumstances than it did looking like Jesus Christ. It broke my heart, but more importantly and thankfully, it broke my far too unexamined faith. Because you have to understand, I learned through failure. I didn't do these things right. I won't be in here as an expert today. John's the expert. I saw this story all the way through. The short version is that John did try to become like me and my roommates. And you know what? He ended up going back to prison for a really long time. It was not the path of healing for him. So now he sits in exile. The gospel I thought that I was teaching was not the gospel that John heard. But don't hear me wrong. You know, I had good intentions. Through this experience, I learned that addiction is not really to one thing or another. Addiction is not ultimately about a thing, really, at all. At its root, addiction is captivity to a false identity. And mine was exactly the same as John's. My identity was me, but only me. Time, resources, beliefs, dreams, they all revolved around me. I was addicted to myself. Worse yet, I thought me was the solution for you. Yeah, that's not so great. But in truth, I was also afraid of otherness. I was afraid of actual relationship, connection, and community with anything different, really anything not me, anything I could not control. That's what I mean by anything not me. So I did what we do when we're afraid of others. I tried to make the other me. When John went back to jail, I realized any attempt on my behalf to help John was like snatching him from the frying pan and throwing him directly into fire. I wasn't sure how deep my self-addiction went or how I had contracted it exactly, but I didn't want to offer John a simple trade on self-obsessions, one addiction for another. In that moment, the most important question in ministry for me ceased to be, how can I help people like John? The most important question became, if I'm an addict, what is addiction then? To clarify, again, I really want to reiterate this. I'm not here to bash on anybody or even myself. I had really good intentions. I am certain that I loved God, or at least the God that I'm comfortable with. I am certain I wanted to help. The problem, as I discovered, was that I deeply believed the story of our culture instead of the story of the cross. Among other things, the story assumes a specific kind of person with specific life doing specific and sanctioned kinds of things is what makes a person good. And since all people should be good, everybody should be that specific kind of person. You know what I mean? But more to the point, what I'm really trying to say is that the American story is kind of like this. The world revolves around me. Good old individual, my preferences are supreme. Pull myself by my own bootstraps up. I'm the hero of my life story. The only thing I need is me. St. Augustine actually, really interestingly, had a term for this long ago. He called this self-interested approach to life the inward curve. The focus of life becomes so intensified on the self, we are lost to the power of sin. And to an extent, this is the root of all sin. As I said from the beginning, we might even state that sin is this inward bend. For further reflection, consider the divine nature revealed in the life of Jesus. When we confess that Jesus is the exact representation of God, we're really confessing that God is triune. Okay, so what does that mean? That means a God whose identity is founded in a love focused on others, outside of the individual self. A divine self which is public in nature, rather than privatized or self-seeking or homogenizing, that is, wanting to make others the same. By God's very nature, God does not seek to destroy or even convert that which is different, not on the grounds of differentiation alone. All of created reality flows from this central relational experience, in fact. Relationship between and among things is the only way that life exists. You take one thing out of the equation and everything goes into chaos. Relationship is not something that God likes. Relationship is something that God is. Practically speaking, when a member of community alienates itself from the whole, it is effectively cutting off all access to the resources necessary to thrive and live. This is what the addict does at the very root. Regardless of the flavor, shade, hue, or tone of addiction, at its heart, addiction is an intensified focus on the self's private desires, manifested in communally destructive attempts to achieve this self-fulfillment. So, returning to the dichotomy of sobriety and addiction, it seems right to again ask the question, what is addiction and what would its opposite be? What is its cure? I have come to believe that sobriety, as defined by our culture, is not the opposite of addiction. Theoretically, the term cannot possibly accommodate addictive behavior. However, practically, the word sobriety has been co-opted and even in function as a form of deeper addiction to the self, especially when it authorizes an egocentric lifestyle of consumption and accumulation. In short, sobriety has come to mean the American dream. The sobriety of the rich and the addiction of the weak are often determined by laws, for example, which are usually determined by those who are already in power. But that's kind of a sidetrack. Getting back to the point, sobriety is not the opposite of addiction. Rather, I've come to believe that the opposite of addiction is connection and community. Connection in right human relationship, though. Not any community will do, really, not in the long run. Right human relationship, which in the end is connection to the image of God that Jesus is trying to reestablish through the reconciliation of his ministry on the cross. John is black Hispanic, I am white. John is from a poor black neighborhood, I am from a privileged one. But where John is addicted to drugs, I am held captive by another inward curve. John's addiction is a substance, my addiction is a lifestyle of self-serving power. Unintentionally, and even against great personal opposition, I became a product of the American dream that I dreaded, the heart of which can foster an intense temptation to the inward curve of the self. Individually realized life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a kingdom for every person. If you're going to bake an inward curve cake, yeah, that might be the ingredients. Maybe on the surface, these ideals seem innocent enough, and I want to take that seriously. At first glance, they might even seem like God-given rights. But if you look deep and hard at the revelation of Jesus Christ, the addiction of our American dream comes into focus for us, and maybe even the depths to which it has pervaded our faith. To clarify, freedom, good. Opportunity, great. Security, awesome. Privatized life imagined apart from interdependence and the sharing of diverse community, or to each a private kingdom, this is a denial of the requisite realities indispensable to the sustenance of human life, even if they don't know God yet. Another clarification. I don't want to stand here and deny the overwhelming goodwill and often good work of most faith communities and nonprofits who wish to help people find healing from addiction. But my caution and challenge is this. Wherever we seek to address addiction through conversion or homogeneity, making them like me, that is from poor to rich, from unemployed to employed, from homeless to self-sufficient, from uneducated to college graduate, from abuse of illegal substances to abuse of the American dream, from black culture to white culture, from you to me, wherever we merely seek to make people into our own image, we've deepened the problem. I pray that we reflect deeply on what we are attempting to save people to, and not only what we are attempting to save people from. Universal sameness is not a solution to the destructive forces afflicting our communities. I am John Dunn. Do you see it now? I am him. I'm still recovering. I remind myself every time I sit down with an addict, I am them, and I need the reminder of what it is I'm doing as an urban minister to begin with. Every time I sit down with an addict, as defined by our culture, I have the privilege of walking with them to freedom. We get to walk towards the cross together. And actually, we have to. In Christ, there is no slave or free addict or sober. The cross really has done away with all of our moralized categories to form convenient scapegoats on which to heap all of our sins so that we can ignore them. At the cross, we no longer view each other from a human point of view, right? Salvation is more than just forgiveness of sins and a home in heaven, as we were reminded last night. Here, salvation is an emergent new reality of vulnerable and often intimate relationship. It's about wholly reconciled community. We have this ministry of reconciliation, Paul says. The ministry of the cross. And now we can say the wonderful cross. And really mean it, which it is the death of the inward curve. That place where we lose our life so that we can actually save it. The truth is, I don't do urban ministry to save addicts, or however you want to word it that way. Really, I do it because I have come to believe that it saves me. I don't do it as a hero. No. I do it as a fellow addict in need of relationship. I am also evangelized when we walk to the cross together. In coming to solidarity with the outcast, I can't help but confess my own sins, which privilege would otherwise cover up, and by extension would otherwise continue to perpetuate destruction in my life and in the lives of those who are close to me. The universal power of the cross is the power to save us from the global destruction which is born of our self-centered lives. Salvation is to follow the God of self-emptying love, who asked us to take a cross and follow him. Because of this love, I have come to believe that salvation is something that happens between people, in relationships, and for the sake of relationship, to the glory of God, who is three. Before handing this conversation over to Dr. Love and Dr. Beck, I want to offer a few reflections, or maybe we'll call them suggestions, on taking steps towards a healthier framework for ministry. This goes to the margins. This is kind of broad. So counselors or ministers seeking to work with the weak, or the addicted, the marginalized, whatever you want to call it, are really called to be midwives of new life, rather than distributors of salvation. Ministers of the gospel are empowered by the Holy Spirit to come alongside the weak in efforts, let's call it threefold. One, in coming to the weak unconditionally, as they are right now, without an agenda of homogeneity, making them like me. Two, by immersing into their life to reignite that spark of holy public so that we're drawn out of the destruction of the private self and into the salvation where everything is in the light and in the presence of God. And three, through mutual confession of sin, joining the weak on the path towards the crucified Lord. This directing to the Lord is not an act of coercion, we understand. It's nor a command. And it's not an act done with words only. We should mimic Paul, who brought a demonstration of the Spirit's power by displaying that Christ has been crucified. This is the power of God. His self-emptying love on the cross. We are called to point people to the cross by carrying one with them and alongside of them. One last thought. I will suggest that we can't call this process of healing uniquely Christian unless it includes the creation of new, diverse, and subversive community. A community which shares in each other's lives and hardships. In short, a community dedicated to following the example that Christ set with that small family of 12 brothers, which is also exemplified time and time again in the earliest chapters of Acts. To close it out, I just want to say it just can't be Yahweh's salvation until it's borne the fruit of holy reconciled community. Richard?
Thanks, John. Did you introduce yourself? Okay, let me tell you who you just heard from. He just jumped in there. He's pretty modest. But it's my great honor to... And I kind of feel unworthy to do this. The comment, actually, on what Josh does. Josh Love is a dear friend and brother. I kind of consider him like the Shane Claiborne of the Churches of Christ. That might not be faddish anymore, but Josh, after graduating from... And even during his time when he was a student at ACU... began living life on the margins in a very poor, the Cockrell, what's that, Stevenson community, where a lot of addiction and prostitution was, and for many, many years, Josh, and still that's a part of his ministry. And so I think both Mark and I often feel indicted by Josh's life. I consider Josh to have a great kind of holiness about him in the way he has walked amongst the poor. And so what you just heard is, you know, the fruits of a great deal of life experiences. So I just wanted to put Josh on your radar screen as a resource person. If you have community ministries or you're a church just trying to reach out to those on the margins, the amount of wisdom and experience, the heartbreak and the victories, and this is a bit of heartbreak but also insight about walking alongside those who are struggling with substance use, get Josh's contact information and bring him to your church and talk to him about the various struggles y'all's churches face, whatever. And it was great, my great privilege to live with Josh at the Freedom Fellowship community of Church Planted Highland. If you read my blog, I tell stories about freedom a lot. We also taught out at the prison on Monday nights together. So that's who Josh Love is. And so just he's kind of the great witness for us. So I want to just say a couple of things. I'll turn it over to Mark to say some theological and ecclesiological things. But I'm going to talk about this as a psychologist. Two quick things. I think what you just heard, there's lots of different cuts we could take at it. But one is we've tended to treat addiction as a qualitatively different kind of thing than what most of us deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's a sin class. It's a behavioral problem. It's kind of a separate thing. It bears its own kind of stigma. It bears its own kinds of interventions. It is just it's a different kind of thing. Or if it's not qualitatively different, it's quantitatively different. If it's not a difference of kind, it's a difference of degree, and it's really, really bad versus the things I deal with as a, you know, middle-class white American, you know, are of lesser degree. So it's not just a difference of kind, it's not a difference of degree, but that all of this curvature inward on the self is a classic to itself. It is all the same kind of thing. And I think that's one of the things I take away from Josh's conversation. And I think one of the reasons why we have treated it as a difference of degree or kind, different from my own sin, is the way we have framed addiction for a couple generations now as a disease. And there are some good things about that move. One of the nice things about framing something as a disease is it places somebody in what we call the sick role, and that should elicit nurturing and understanding. Like if somebody's ill, they can't be blamed. And so there's a benefit there from framing something as a moral failure. Like it used to be you were just a drunk. It was a moral failure. And we've shifted to more medicalized language, which lowers the degree of agency of the person. Right? You can't be blamed for having cancer. And so it reduces blame and therefore hopefully reduces stigma. And so I think there's some benefits, and I think that there's been more compassion that flows out of that shift to the disease model. But I think there's also been, the downside is some of the things Josh was talking about. It's now become, like, most of your sins you don't consider to be disease states. And so it's a different thing. It's a disease now. And so that's the downside of this. It's also created a separation. And so lots of psychologists are kind of rethinking the disease model as a metaphor for what we're talking about. Disease perhaps might be a good metaphor for addiction, but I should also say that the church fathers have always used illness as a metaphor for sin, and that salvation, working out at the prison, the metaphor of healing is become more and more powerful in my life. Because I think most of us, the metaphor we have for sin is it's an error, like a performance failure. I made a mistake, I get forgiven, and therefore slate is wiped clean. But if sin is a sickness, if it's a sickness that saturates your existence, and we're all ill, then we can kind of cry out in that old spiritual, like, is there a balm in Gilead? Is there medicine for what makes me ill? So when I work with people dealing with addictions, I work with the men at the prison, that's what they struggle with, is sin. They get that there's bad things, but what they really struggle with is this deep sense of something's wrong with me. I am curved inward upon the self, and I can't, how do I heal that? To shift again, away from the disease model, lots of psychologists are suggesting that addiction makes sense. It's a rational choice. and that might seem strange. That's a little weird for y'all probably too. But we have so incentivized American society, and particularly the way the incentives have been set up for the poor, this is not a bad option for them. That might be hard to get your head around, but so I was. Let me ask you this question. Family of four, I have a family of four. How much does it take to go to Taco Bell and the movies? How much does that take? What is that? It's like $60, right? Family of four at Taco Bell. So I went low on you guys. I went like, let's eat cheap. It's going to be like $20-$30 at Taco Bell. Like everybody gets drinks, you know. It's the sugar water that's killing us. It's you know, everybody just drink water here tonight. Like Taco Bell's like $20-some, and then it's $10. It's like $60 to go to Taco Bell in a movie.
If it's not popcorn.
If it what?
Are you getting nachos?
Yeah, right. Okay, all right. My point here is think about that. Think about now you're a poor person in America, and you can't even afford that pleasure. You can't even afford that pleasure, let alone the weekend we're all experiencing out here at Malibu. So some people say addiction, it's a physiological thing. It's all physiological. We're all being reinforced, serotonin and dopamine. We're all getting our buzzes, and we're getting euphorias and excitements and thrills. And this whole weekend is packed with those good feelings, and they are all physiological. You know, they're not and so to suggest that somehow the physiological aspects of the reinforcement circuitry of drugs is somehow qualitatively different than the buzz you get because – you know, you did something great, you got a good job. I just want to suggest that, and you might say, well, the trouble with addiction is you're sacrificing short-term pleasure for long-term pleasure. But if you don't have a future you can envision, mm-hmm. and if your future is just, you know, the kind of the hell of poverty, lots of people are suggesting that this isn't a different kind of thing. We're all making choices, given the incentives that we're facing. And for some people, this might just not be a bad choice for them. It might not make sense to us as middle-class white people, but it has a logic to it. And so let me wrap this up and shift it over to Mark to move to community. Because of the disease model, we've tended to focus on thinking about addiction as a very individualized kind of treatment. It's on the person to get themselves better. We send them off to rehab, we get clean, and we expect them to come back, you know, middle-class, well-adjusted white person. Or they go to AA, and, you know, they it's on them to kind of get themselves fixed. And lots of people are suggesting that if people are making rational choices, what we need to help with addiction is to help people re-incentivize their lives, to envision futures and envision options that they can choose. And so therefore, moving people toward health is helping embed them in communities where they can envision a new future. They can make a different kind of choice because some different rewards are out there in front of them. So the idea of the addict is somebody who's like completely out of control and they can't make a good decision because of the physiological thing. Psychologists start to question that. And so let me suggest that one of the things we can do, talking more about what Josh was saying, is that we create communities, Mark will talk about this in a second, that help people kind of re-envision a future in some relationships. One quick example from Freedom Fellowship, Miss Beth, who passed away recently in our community. Miss Beth was a meth addict, and she came across our job training called Faith Works, started getting embedded at the faith community at Freedom, started cooking for us, became a leader, a ministry leader there, and became one of the great leaders of our faith community there. And so she goes from meth addiction to somebody working and a leader. She's bossing me around, you know, like I'm like, Miss Beth, what do we do? Like so the lower made high and mightier brought down, and I'm mopping floors and she's telling me what to do. It all happens because she became embedded in a faith community where a different kind of life could be chosen instead of meth. And if we aren't giving people those options, we're just like, just go get sobered up and come back. And nothing changes. Their life is exactly the same. And if we are welcoming people to a life where they can feel good about themselves, and they can get that buzz that we take for granted, then we're just condemning people. These cycles are going back and forth and back and forth. But that's going to place an enormous burden upon the church. And so let's shift that over to Mark and let him talk about the ecclesial implications of that.
Let me first say, if I can do it without crying, can't, that Josh is my rabbi. And for a father to feel that toward his son is an amazing thing. So I want to talk for just a few minutes about ecclesiology, that is, the teaching about the church or the practice of the church, because Josh has given us precisely that today. And I think exposed ways in which we're not actually the church. He calls us into real community, not just an association of like-minded, like-looking, like-income level, like people who like the same songs and think the preacher's pretty good, but he calls us rather into community. Josh's paper says that church isn't a place where people who have it all together hang out, but church is the primary location in which all of us experience the salvation of God. Because we're in community, because we're living toward the kingdom of God with people who are other than us. Josh talked about the hyper preoccupation with the individual, the inward curve that St. Augustine talked about. Church, then, if that's our sinful condition from which we need to be liberated, then church is the necessary condition for our being saved. In other words, church becomes the place where we encounter people who are other than us. And in their otherness, inconvenience us. And in that inconvenience, interrupt us and challenge our sense of importance. Confront us with the truly other, God. In doing so, unmask who we are. So Josh says, I am John. The experience of otherness in community, in obligation toward one another, ultimately unmasks our own pretensions about who we are and calls us again to the cross. So church isn't place where people who are saved hang out together. It's a place where people who know their need hang out together in order to be saved. And for a long time, I've been dealing with the idea that for church to be church, for Jesus to be Lord of all, that means that it has to work for the least of these. And I have to tell you, I have yet to be a part of a church where it works for the least of these. That the level of cultural competence required for people to participate in most of our congregations excludes many, many people. Not only that they have to feel welcome, but the practices that we share have to work for the least of these. Not only do do they have to work for the least of these? But I think the least of these should be the people who lead the rest of us in these practices, because they're closer to them. I think one of the strong things about Josh's paper is that it awakens those of us who have more socially respectable addictions to the fact that we get a lot of help from our culture in feeling okay about who we are, right? And so it's the people who are already fully aware of who they are and how they're addicted that should be the ones who lead us in practices. And for that to happen, then the practices have to be simple and powerful. Josh talked about confession as a practice. I'm not good at confession. You know why? Because I've buried my stuff under a veneer of respectability, and I go to church on Sunday morning. I don't raise my hands or clap, but I do get a certain buzz because I know how to sing tenor well and therefore feel competent in the system that helps support and cover over my addictions. At church last week, I heard a well-meaning elder refer to homeless people as our clients. There's no church there, right? And I think Josh's paper pulls back the curtain on that. So I want to talk briefly about two things. One, about pastoral practice, our kind of well-meaning ways that we've treated identified addicted populations that are harmful, that don't have anything to do with the gospel. And then offer instead a few ideas about shared practices that might help us become churches. Paul has this wonderful text that's often overlooked in Galatians, where he contrasts his own pastoral style to that of the Judaizers, those who would kind of have you measure up to a law or certain standards. He says, they make much of you. Now, let's make the they there well-meaning, suburban church folks wanting to be superheroes in impoverished neighborhoods. They make much of you to exclude you. In other words, if I'm fussing over you, if I'm bringing all the good stuff, then it's pretty easy for you to self-identify as the client, as the problem, as the excluded one. So Paul says they make much of you to exclude you so that you in turn might make much of them. And there's the little hit of endorphin on our addiction, right? So that they might make much of us. And yet, I bet that most of you could identify with the statement that we do all these wonderful things for these people, and we can't figure out why they never become members of our congregations. Okay? And there are a lot of reasons for that. But I want to suggest the second thing, beyond kind of the pastoral legalism we have in a lot of our approaches toward addicted populations, that the location of the church has to change and the nature of the practices of the church have to change. We will not be diverse communities that welcome those that have been identified or who participate in poverty in our suburban enclaves. It won't happen. The kind of cross-cultural competence required to do that, we wouldn't be able to do if we were crossing. It puts all the burden on them, right? So we're going to have to find ways to create community where they are, to empty ourselves, to sell our buildings, to give up our privilege, to create new patterns of community that make the least of these the validation of what we're doing. And then I think we'll have to, because this is going to be hard work, right? And community's never easy. Clubs are easy, but community is never easy, right? So we're going to have to create simple practices that are easily repeatable. My teacher says that liturgy is the way that strangers participate together in life. So to find basic little liturgies that we can share, and the woman who's teaching me about that right now is Becca Stevens in Nashville with the Thistle Farms community that invite women trying to escape from sex trade work. And they have beautiful, simple little liturgies that are led not by Becca, who's an ordained Episcopal priest, but by the women in the community. Lighting a candle, saying a prayer, affirming love, confessing sin. Sounds an awful lot like church. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to have to give up 18 contemporary songs on Sunday morning to do that. But again, this is part of what I mean by cultural competence, right? And to me, well, I'm getting off, but I'm going to say this. Our songs, to me, are like turning up the volume on the car radio to avoid hearing the pinging of the engine as we go down the road. And these more simple liturgies, practices, led by people who live closer to the vulnerable places that those should expose, would offer us the chance, before it's too late, to be the church. So what do you think, Josh? What should we do now? How much time do we have?
We're over.
We're over?
Yeah,
all right. Thanks for coming.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.